Alec Greenblatt is a political reporter for Governing, has also reported for NPR, among other organizations, and he joins me on the phone this morning. Alan, thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Illinois, of course, going through some fiscal issues at the moment. The new governor, Bruce Rauner, has put some items on what he calls his turnaround agenda that the Democratic-controlled legislature is not particularly keen on implementing. Those items prerequisites for the governor increasing any kind of revenue here in the state. And I wanted to talk to you about a couple of those topics today, one of them being term limits. I know you've covered term limits on a general basis for governing and just how they've worked in some other states. I guess first, I'd ask you, Alan, about how many states right now have some form of term limits in place for their legislative branch?
I believe it's 15 states, and most of those states have term limits because of ballot measures. You know, the politicians didn't want to approve it, but voters were able to vote for them directly.
How do some of those vary? I know some of the term limits are stricter than others. What's some of the range we're looking at there?
Well, they do range from, I think the lowest is 6 years to 12 years, and those are usually per chamber. In other words, you could serve 6 years in the state house and then 6 years in the state senate or whatever the case may be. And that's really where the movement has been in the last few years. There haven't been a lot of states adopting term limits for about a decade or so. I can't remember the last one even. And states that do have them have lengthened the term limits. In some states, they've made it so you could serve, let's say, 12 years in either chamber. So you could have a 12 years in the House, but then you couldn't serve in the Senate. Other states have just made them longer. And what has happened, you know, term limits are very unpopular with legislators because they feel like they barely get a chance to learn the job and who all the players are throughout the government and all the complicated issues that they have to master. And then suddenly they have to be thinking about their next job. So legislators in states like Arkansas and California, they've either changed or gotten voters to approve changes, allowing them to serve a little bit longer without abolishing term limits altogether.
Yeah, what's some of the impact you've seen in states that have adopted those term limits? You mentioned the legislators' perspective. What about from other perspectives, maybe the executive branch that's working with the legislature, the lobbyists? What are some other perspectives on how term limits have worked?
Well, term limits is an issue where how it looks in the state capital and how it looks in the rest of the state are totally different things. And the public generally supports term limits. People love the idea that politicians shouldn't stick around forever. They all feel like people go and become entrenched in the capital culture and become corrupt and forget why they're there and pursue their own agendas and all those kind of things. So for that reason, term limits, if you poll on term limits, remains very popular. But if you ask people in and around the state capitol, everybody pretty much hates it. Legislators don't like it because it does limit their power. They can't build up seniority and knowledge and so forth. And so the result is power shifts to other players, whether it's staff that gets to stick around forever and knows more about a subject than the legislators they're working for, whether it's executive branch agencies. You know, it has tended to make governors more powerful and agencies get away with more. Legislators make fewer changes to governors' budgets after term limits pass. And so it strengthens the hand of the governor. But on the other hand, for both governors and lobbyists, they tend not to like it either because they don't have negotiating partners. They don't have people with expertise in the legislature that they can deal with. So if you're a lobbyist, rather than having your one buddy be the chairman for 20 years, you have to constantly be reintroducing yourself to new people who are going to tend not to trust you. So for people in the state government culture professionally, they tend not to like it, even the ones who tend to get more power as a result.
Well, here in Illinois, Governor Rauner has proposed term limits for the legislature, no mention of any term limits for the executive branch in his proposal. I'm just curious, Alan, in terms of the executive branch, how common are term limits there as we look at the 50 states?
More common than not. Most governors are limited to 2 4-year terms. There are some exceptions, like Wisconsin. So over most states have governors limited to 8 years. Virginia has a one-term limit of 4 years, but most governors are term limited. And I don't think it's super common for positions like state attorneys general and so forth, but generally they do sort of follow the governors in a lot of states.
Very good. Talking with Alan Greenblatt, political reporter for Governing, about some of the issues on Governor Bruce Rauner's turnaround agenda. Another one, Alan, of course, is redistricting. And, of course, the Supreme Court just recently helped decide that redistricting at least can continue in theory after the case they decided. If you could just briefly summarize what was being challenged in that Supreme Court case and what the court decided.
Well, so redistricting is, as the name suggests, the job of drawing new districts, both for state legislative seats and for congressional seats, every 10 years. We have the census every 10 years, and then the districts are supposed to have equal population size, and so you have to adjust. And redistricting is heavily political. Whichever party has control, they want to draw the most districts that will elect members of their party as possible and protect incumbents and all that kinds of thing. So a lot of people feel redistricting is a big reason why we have so much polarization, especially in Congress, that politicians only have to answer to voters of one party or the other, and therefore they tend to be more extreme. And there's a lot of debate about that, because the reality is that people have kind of sorted themselves into partisan areas one way or the other. You know, Democrats tend to live in highly dense areas like, say, Chicago, and Republicans tend to live in more sparsely populated areas. And so no matter how you draw the districts, there's going to be a lot of Democrats packed into the metropolitan centers. But anyway, redistricting does certainly tend to exaggerate those effects. So anyway, because people think redistricting makes politics more partisan, there's been a desire to find alternatives and have it become a nonpartisan process. And so in Arizona, voters had approved a ballot measure taking redistricting out of the hands of the legislature, which is how it's controlled in most states, and giving it to a commission. And there are about a dozen different commissions around the country, different bodies that have the final say over redistricting as opposed to the legislature itself. And so in the Constitution, it says that election law belongs to the legislature. And the argument in the Supreme Court was, well, that just must mean the legislature is in charge of redistricting. But what the Supreme Court found was that there's plenty of precedent that by the word legislature, the Constitution is really referring to the legislative process, which is any kind of lawmaking in states that allow ballot measures that could certainly include election law. So anyway, the Supreme Court said if you want to set up an alternative process for redistricting, give it to somebody other than the legislature, that is okay.
As far as that goes, you said about a dozen states have approved that in some form, some kind of a commission with the final say on those redistricting decisions. What kind of impact have you seen there? How different have the districts been under commissions rather than being drawn under the legislature?
Well, so when you're drawing districts, you can have all kinds of different goals in mind, whether it's to make districts more competitive or make them more compact, as small as possible, not having little tendrils sneaking out to grab more voters who are Democratic or Republican or whatever, to keep counties intact and so on and so forth. And so these different commissions have kind of different goals in mind. And the intent of them is to make it less overtly partisan and have them not solely thinking about electing more Republicans or more Democrats or protecting more incumbents by giving them safe districts. And it does vary because the commissions are all different. Iowa's usually sort of heralded as the best one, and it's actually not an independent commission. It's run by legislative staff, but they're not allowed to know things, for instance, such as the home addresses of incumbents. So they draw districts not knowing even where the incumbents are going to be. And so they've come up with seemingly more districts that are competitive than most. Whereas in California, they have this very complex commission that was also set up by a ballot measure a few years ago. And it has seemed to make things less partisan. And again, it's just the natural geography. Most of the Democrats live along the coast in California, and more Republicans live inland. There have been a few more competitive elections in California. It used to be that you'd have an entire cycle and no incumbent would lose at the congressional level or the legislative level. And there are a few more competitive districts, but that's really more. They also changed, so they don't have partisan primaries. They have everybody on the same ballot. So sometimes you'll have two Democrats or two Republicans in one district, and then the incumbent. Redistricting hasn't made it all that much more competitive. But, you know, you do have states where legislatures draw the districts, and hardly any incumbents even get challenged. So incumbents do tend to win overwhelmingly, but it does seem like in some of the redistricting states with commissions, there's a little more competition and a little more challenge to incumbents.
Sure. Before I let you go, Alan, this isn't really a term limit question per se, but it's a leadership question in the legislature. It's often pointed out that Michael Madigan has been the Speaker of the Illinois House for nearly 30 years, only interrupted for a couple of years in the 90s when Republicans took control of the legislature. What kind of rules are in place in other states as far as leadership in a particular legislative body? Are there any restrictions on that as you look around the country?
Not so much. I mean, these leaders who are in power for a long time do tend to prompt a term limits discussion. In California, for instance, the voters approved of term limits there at a time when Willie Brown had been Speaker for like 14 years. But there are some other states like Maryland and Tennessee and whatnot who've had people in the top leadership position for 20, 30 years. Sheldon Silver, the Assembly Speaker in New York, who got indicted early this year, he'd been in power, I think, roughly as long as Speaker Madigan. So, again, it's an exception, but I think leadership turnover tends to happen kind of naturally. The people run for their offices or their party loses power or what have you, but there aren't typically term limits on how long somebody can hold the job of Speaker or State Senate President or Majority Leader.
All right. Alan Greenblatt, political reporter for Governing. We appreciate your time here today. Alan, thanks for the insight.
Oh, thanks very much.